So hi, this is Ron. Welcome everyone and thank you for joining. It's exciting to have so many people on this call. I believe registration was close to 100, which is really, really great. I want to start by giving you a little bit of background about this call and about Meaningful Goal Pursuit, or MGP for short. The topic of Meaningful Goal Pursuit is something that I came across when I was running a technology company a few years ago. I was creating at the time self-directed, self-coaching applications, mobile applications and web applications, and working with different psychologists from different disciplines. And we were trying to create these programs and realizing that this field of practice and of research is a little fragmented. What I mean by that is, in terms of the tools, you have a variety of tools from motivation science that you can use, a variety of models and theories from that domain of, again, of both practice and research, a variety of tools that have to do with visualization and creating a vision separately, a variety of tools obviously pertaining to goals, SMART goals, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, and lots of goals, models, and a lot of books around goal setting and goal pursuit. And there was also a great body of research about behavior change, triggers and setting cues, and a lot of interesting tools that are typically used in kind of narrower settings, like smoking cessation or weight loss programs. And we identified a need to create a single framework that puts all of this together. You need to introduce some more structure into the process. Initially, that need was a necessity for creating the software, because software is very structured, and it was impossible to have the type of flexibility and fluidity that you have in a coaching conversation or in human interaction. But then we realized that the structure is something important. It's more than just a nice to have, because the structure reduces friction. And let me explain a little bit what I mean by that. Imagine for a second, it's 1961. President Kennedy asked you to be in charge of the Apollo program. And that is very meaningful to you. You say, wow, I love the vision. I definitely feel motivated. And I would really be excited to put a man on the moon, but I'm not sure how to do that. And the structure helps you reduce that friction in the following way. On one hand, the way to do that is to maintain that grand vision, that's something that lights you up, that's something that is ambitious and is grand and is meaningful and is profound. It's very important to keep that in the background on a daily basis. But on the other hand, while the vision remains there, the focus each day is on the pedestrian stuff. You know, imagine it's now 1963 and you're working on a chip inside a circuit board, inside a box, inside one of the spaceships that goes on one of the Apollo missions towards that vision of putting a man on the moon. You got to be able to also focus on that pedestrian stuff and the challenges you meet in your workday to make that grand vision happen. So accomplishing this grand vision one day at a time and reducing the friction and the anxiety that can come with setting very ambitious goals and very grand goals and looking at a grand vision is what this is, to a large extent, this is what it's all about. So that's kind of the motivation behind the structure as well. And so back then, coming back to the software, we were working together with different scientists, social psychologists, clinical psychologists, personality psychologists, and putting together this framework that walks a person through a sequential process. It starts with digging in and creating a meaningful vision for the future. It goes through breaking down that vision into specific goals and collecting them into an action plan, all the way to the daily pursuit of the goals and finding ways to keep the momentum going and to take steps each and every day. And again, the emphasis is kind of on these pedestrian steps, because at the end of the day, it's all footwork that you got to do, and the challenge is to keep the motivation going. So I will tell you more about this framework today. This call, as you may know, is towards a full course. It's a 10-hour course that I'll be teaching for the second year now, starting next month. I'm also excited to say the course was approved by the Coaching Psychology Graduate Program in Middlesex University. So it's also a vehicle to provide credits towards that that program. And I hope you'll find it useful in your coaching and just in your daily life. Let me start, and we'll have some time for questions at the end. So I'll try to make kind of the talk part of it brief as much as possible. I think from a housekeeping perspective, if you want to unmute, you need to press star 6. I think everyone is muted by default. And to mute yourself back, you press the same thing. It's star 6. So if you have something pressing that you really want to ask, feel free to interject. And if not, we'll leave some time for questions at the end. Before talking about the process itself in a little bit more detail and the motivation behind it and the components of it, I'd like to tell you a little bit more about myself. You know, so you know a little bit. You know that I come from technology, and this is how I kind of stumbled upon this. In my education, I'm an engineer, both undergraduate and graduate school. I started my career in the Israeli Defense Forces, and in the first years, I focused on algorithm development, analytics, data mining, signal processing, a lot of heavy-duty stuff, defense stuff that is very, very far removed from anything transformative, anything that has to do with coaching or even that has to do with psychology. I moved to the U.S. early on in my career, and I worked in different research labs. One of them was IBM Research in Yorktown, upstate New York. And while I was there, I got interested in psychology and how some pieces of it can be softwareized, how some pieces of it can be made into software. The interesting thing at the time was there were, and I think it's still the case to an extent, there were a lot of very interesting tools that can be used in a professional context, some of them very structured, some of them very quantitative, but they were not available to the general public. And it seems like the channels, you know, the web channel and then later on mobile channel, would be a very interesting way to bring that value to the public in a way that is less expensive and more approachable and maybe even better in some respects. So I started a company 8 years ago called Signal Patterns. And in a few years, we found ourselves working with famous psychologists, people like Lou Goldberg, who's considered to be the father of modern personality psychology, Phil Zimbardo, who's best known for the Stanford Prison Experiment, positive psychologists like Sonia Lubomirsky, and also famous authors like Stephen Covey and Deepak Chopra. And like I said, we were working on creating these self-directed programs together. We pioneered really what's today called digital programs for mobile intervention or mobile assessments. It was something very new at the time and still emerging, I think, to date. And we didn't realize it back then, but what we were really creating were self-coaching programs. Myself and the other people in my team, none of them came from a coaching background, so it took us some time to realize that that's really what we're doing. But in hindsight, that was really the case even back then in the earlier stages. And then during that time, we started developing this concept of meaningful goal pursuit. It's not finalized yet, but it was something that started to build up. In 2010, the content started kind of seeping in personally for me as well and stopped being just something that I do for my day job and for intellectual interest. And I started going through my own personal transformation. And I used the meaningful goal pursuit process myself, the one I was still working on, to transform my own life. I used one of the applications we released in 2009, and long story short, I got a motorcycle license, and about a year later, I found myself riding from coast to coast for 5 weeks on my own, for 6,000 miles from New York to California, and interviewing a lot of the interesting people I work with, people like Deepak Chopra, Byron Katie, Barbara Fredrickson, Jamie Pennebaker, Zimbardo, and others, And this is really the other piece of the equation. I think some of the things I'm going to describe to you today may sound a little bit mechanic because of my background, and you know, engineers like to think in block diagrams in a very, very kind of ultra-structured way, but alongside the science and the structure and the tools, there needs to be a heart, kind of a brain and a heart. And I think there's an overarching thing that has to put in everything together, which is why this course is called Meaningful Goal Pursuit, Go on the Ride of Your Life. To finish the story, when I rode the motorcycle to California, in Los Angeles I met with a company and I negotiated the sale of the company with them along the way, other entrepreneurs who were starting a company in a similar domain, and I shook hands with them in L.A. and decided to sell the company and became their chief scientist and joined their team. I got back home to New York and decided to change things. You know, in the first week, I got a dog. It was a childhood dream of mine, and I always thought, like, hey, it's got to shed hair, it's going to be messy, it's going to be difficult to take care of. It was kind of the immediate thing I did. And then deeper into that, realized I want to be a part of the coaching community and learn more about it, and I got certified at IOCT as in the first round of people who got the board certified coach credential, and started coaching and then started teaching at IOCT about a year later, and really started looking at things more from a coaching perspective, realizing that coaching is really the glue that puts all of this stuff together, the tools, the knowledge, but also the kind of the heart piece that I was talking about, and you know, these great things like the Coaching Alliance and you know, things from the human world that I was less familiar with my quantitative or engineering background. I also decided to make other changes in my life. I moved back to Israel with my family where I grew up, which is where I'm calling you from. And today I'm still the chief scientist of BeLife, the company that acquired my company, but I also teach, write, and coach. I spend a lot of time in New York and Los Angeles, in addition to the time I spend here in my new home base in Tel Aviv. And, you know, on a personal note, this process has really transformed my own life, so it made me very, obviously very passionate about it, seeing it both in my own life and in the lives of people that I coach. So that's generally the background about what this is about, why I think it's important, and what it has done for me in my own life. We talked about the need for meaningful goal pursuit and the need to reduce friction, right? And this concept of bottom-up and doing the footwork and all of that stuff. So let's talk about the process itself. So this MGP process starts with a vision. It starts with a vision that sometimes I refer to as a multidimensional vision. And what I mean by that is the following. You start in your work with a client with a miracle question. You know, miracle question, which I'm sure some of you are familiar with, and there are the different variants of that, comes from solution-focused therapy. The general gist of it is you snap your fingers and, you know, everything you wish for comes through. What is it? You know, what is that ideal vision with no limits and no constraints whatsoever? Then looking at that vision again from a slightly different lens with an exercise called Best Possible Self that comes from positive psychology. Originally, that was an exercise that was developed to cultivate optimism, but the nice thing about it is it's Best Possible Self. So it takes things down a notch and starts looking at the practical aspects and whether the goals are attainable or whether that vision, that ideal vision, is possible. You know, one example is if I'm in my 50s and my grand vision is to win a gold medal in the Olympics, well, that's not happening. So, you know, you have to think about these things as well, kind of tone it down into a possible scenario while keeping the excitement and while keeping the vision in mind, maybe just tweaking it a little bit. And then also going through a visualization exercise of a day in the life, which I think is kind of the third dimension. I think for a lot of people, they would say, I want to be famous, or I want to work with Oprah, or, you know, something that's a little abstract, But thinking about a day in your life and what you have for breakfast and where it is you wake up and where it is you live and who you wake up next to and what's the first thing you do in the morning and do you get in your car and drive and what car is it and where do you go, that kind of thing puts a very real dimension into your vision. So that's the first step, really to develop a vision that's detailed, that's clear, that's focused, and to start with that starting point that's free from self-limiting beliefs, self-limiting thoughts, and free from a lot of constraints that people perceive to be constraints but really have to do with choices that they can make. And the interesting thing there is, again, if you don't go through one exercise, you go through a few of them, there's some reduction of friction because it just feels like a little game, you know, initially. The next step, once you have that grand vision in place, is to break it down into goals. And I find that for a lot of people, that is a huge source of friction as well. Goals are starting to be more concrete. Sometimes people have a tendency to kind of quote-unquote cheat on their goals and maybe make them such that they're not easily measurable, right? Sometimes people will take a step back and say, well, that's a great vision, but if I need to commit to something a year from today, I'm not sure I want to do that. It's a big source of friction, and the way to work around that is to create a set of candidate goals. And candidate goals are just goals that you may want to pursue when you break down this vision. You're not committing to them yet. You're not, you're not finalizing them yet. You're going to edit them and change them. So it feels like an exercise on paper, and it's great to have that because then the client goes into a mindset where they're still working a little bit in the virtual world. They don't have to deal with the possible anxiety of just going out and doing it. And the thing there is to create a large set of candidate goals because, you know, the paper tolerates anything. You can write and write and write. And when you think about it in a way which is this is just stuff that I may consider at some point to pursue, then a lot of things come out and sometimes a lot of great things as well. And the next step then is to vet these goals, to iterate on them and change the way they're worded. And this is where SMART goals comes in. So you vet the goals to see that they're specific, measurable, attainable, and so on. You vet the goals also through a lens of intrinsic goals or self-determination theory. Try to word the goals in a way that increases the three human needs according to that theory, which is competency and autonomy and connectedness. And also look at it through this third lens of self-concordance goals. So kind of use these theories to go through these goals two or three times and change them before you commit to them. And then once you have your list and you like it and you like each individual goal the way it's written down, you have what we call good candidate goals. And then you pick a subset. And I think there are two reasons to do that. One is when you pick a subset and you know up front you're going to pick a subset, then it makes it easier to come up with more of these. But also you benefit from having focus. And this is kind of the point in time where a person may have 20 of these written down, but realistically some of them may be conflicting. You know, they may not have enough time to do all of it. And the process of looking at that list and saying, out of the 20 or so, I'm going to pick only 7 or 8, that's a great process because it forces the person also to focus on what's really important to them and what is meaningful to them. And it's a great way to prioritize. In this call, I'm not going to have enough time to go into the details, but the process results in some scores and some way to do this and rank these goals so that the goals that are supposed to be better candidates based on the person's input, they kind of rank higher at the top. And I like this very much. In my example, the way I found myself on a motorcycle is that going through those exercises, the goals that had to do with that motorcycle thing, which initially I just thought was some recreational fun side thing, kept ranking at the top, and that was very insightful to me. That is something meaningful to me that I actually want to do. And you can think about it also as this funnel, right, of distilling more and more meaning at each stage, where you start with this vision that's a little abstract and a little broad, and then narrowing it down and tightening it down and making it more and more concrete as you go. So at this point in time, the client has a set of goals that they're committed to, and, you know, again, maybe 7 to 10 of them typically, and these goals are the person's action plan for the future. And then it's time to visualize them. The reason visualization is important is there's a lot of research showing that basically visualization is a great bridge between planning and execution. Possibly in that process, as I'm sure many of you experience, you know, yourself and with your clients, having the rubber meet the road is the biggest point of friction. And you got to really start doing something. It's really hard to do that if you don't have a clear mental image in your mind of what the process is going to look like. You know, at that point in time, you've spent a lot of time thinking about the vision and where you want to go, but not exactly about what's going to happen next week or a month from today. And there's a great exercise that was developed in NYU in the past few years called mental. I think a lot of people think of visualization as this law of attraction type of thing. So you kind of visualize the success. The research shows that it's really, really important also to try to visualize the obstacles and try to visualize the challenges. And at the same time, try to visualize how you will work around them. So a person might visualize themselves if they want to work on their first novel, for example, being successful and being on book tour, but also it's very beneficial for them to visualize that it's late at night and they're tired and they got to go to work in the morning, but they're still working on that book and how they're going to work around that and how they're going to feel. And that's really important because when that happens, then in reality, down the road, the person feels kind of prepared mentally and just kind of swerve around the obstacle and continue instead of stopping in their tracks and being anxious about it as if it's something that was just not expected. I think, in general, a big component of this process is to start with something ideal and something positive, but also not to ignore the realities and the challenges of the journey itself. So that's the next step. And then it's time to take action. So, again, that's the biggest friction point. What we use and what I use in MGP is something called the baby step. So you look at your goals and you pick at least one, you can pick more, one step, one tiny thing that you can complete within the next 7 days. Can be anything tiny, anything. It doesn't have to be consequential, significant, or important, or dramatic. And in fact, it's probably better for it not to be that way. Just one thing that you can tell yourself in 7 days' time, I did this. And there's a tremendous value to that. Because once a person goes and does this step, they can feel that they've made the transition into execution and into the real pursuit, the daily pursuit of their action plan. And there's an enormous sense of pride that comes with it. I can tell you in my story, anecdotally, you know, my first baby step when I was just contemplating doing something was to go to a dealership and ask them how does one get a motorcycle license. I had no idea. I was, you know, about 40 at the time. And it seems like something inconsequential. I mean, you just go to the dealership. It takes 10 minutes. There's one close to where I used to live. You get in and you just ask. But it's hard. It's hard to put yourself in the car outside your normal routine, outside your commute, and go into that dealership and, you know, talk to a guy who's maybe been riding motorcycles since they were a teenager. And sure enough, that's what happened. You know, I had to do this because this was on my plan, and again, viewed it as something pedestrian. And I actually took my son, who was 7 at the time, and got in with him and pretended that he and I just happened to walk outside the dealership, and he was excited about the motorcycles and he wanted to get in. So I did that. And, you know, I get in, the guy behind the counter rolled his eyes and saw another guy with a midlife crisis. It was just a very, very difficult thing to do.
Very good.
But it was great. I got a leaflet. I got out. I was all sweaty. And I was just like, hey, I did it. I know what to do next. I have this piece of paper in my hand that tells me what are the steps to go through. And all of a sudden, I felt like this thing could happen, could really happen. You know, not to mention that I got some quality time with my kid, which is, you know, a nice byproduct. So this is really, really important, I think. And again, coming back to this notion of breaking down a grand task into tiny steps, it's a wonderful thing. And then once you're starting to have some momentum, I think there's one big misperception that people sometimes have is that motivation that comes from that vision in your mind is going to drive you every day. And if you think about the way people behave on a daily basis, it's not the case. People work, I almost want to say mindlessly, right, most of the time on autopilot. It's something that we're trying to combat and change, you know, to have people have a more mindful type of living and be more present. But the reality is people respond very well to triggers. I think one of the great examples, and I forget the source of that people give is if you want to start running in the mornings, one of the most effective things you can do is put your running shoes and your sports clothes on, you know, just beside your bed. So when you wake up, that's going to be those are going to be the clothes you put on. You put on the running shoes you put on the sneakers, and you're not dressed for work. You're dressed to run. Chances are you're going to find yourself running, just like that. So there's a lot of interesting theory and a lot of research about that. Basically, harnessing that capability of how to weave these little tasks into a person's routine and how to do it in a way where it actually doesn't mandate that energy of thinking about, I want to be there, I want to write my novel, I'm imagining myself, which could be actually draining. It's just something in my schedule. It's just a thing I need to do. It's just a reminder that popped up, or maybe the computer is behind my bed, is next to my bed, or I don't know, something that visually just kind of makes me do it the same way I do everything, you know, the same way I go grocery shopping, the same way I find myself going to work in the morning, just kind of part of that routine and almost habituate that new behavior of pursuing that goal. And again, that reduces a lot of friction because you want to have that grand vision, you know, lighting you up on one hand, but on the other hand, you want to just do it without thinking about it too much. There are others. Things that could be useful there. There are ways to maintain motivation in terms of mindset. There's great research about getting better versus being good mindset and studies that show that people who think about their goal in terms of ultimate performance as opposed to their relative incremental progress over time actually end up performing worse. So the short of it is, it's just really useful every now and then to go back, look at where I was when I started and look at where I am now and just give yourself a big pat on the back. And then the final thing is also to remember to be flexible. Which I think after the initial hurdle of getting rid of that friction and stuff starts happening and there is momentum, a lot of people discover that they're probably not going to obtain their action plan exactly the way they had envisioned it. Just things happen, life happens, there's new information that comes along the way, Your level of knowledge of the new thing you're pursuing is much higher, so you know much more about it. And, you know, I tell my clients sometimes, I say, listen, I mean, this is a great vision. You know, if you're discouraged, keep in mind the chances that you'll obtain that vision exactly the way you envisioned it is probably very low. But the great thing is you're going to get something maybe better than that, because as you go, you learn and you tweak and you change. So maintaining that flexibility over time, I think, is really, 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 really key. And just not being fixated, you know, on the way you think things are supposed to be, and not being, to use maybe a different word that's used in different wisdom traditions, sometimes not to be attached to that outcome. There's a great sentence. I don't know if I'll quote it exactly or precisely, but both in the Bhagavad Gita and in the Da Ching, there's a quote that goes something like, focus on your action, not on its fruit. And I think a lot of that process goes down to that. If you want to have that fruit in mind, and that's what you want to reap at the end, but the action is really what's important. And of course, the cliche of it's the journey and not the destination, which became a cliche because it's probably right. So that is the process. It's used in some of our company's applications, roughly. I use it with my clients. It's great to see momentum build up. It's great to see people stretching themselves. And it's great to see also people kind of, you know, quote-unquote, being tricked into personal transformation, which is kind of what happened to me. I think the beautiful thing is in this approach is by reducing the friction, you start with something that feels more pedestrian and less intimidating. Most of you, I would guess, would agree that that's not enough. And at some point, there's a shift that needs to happen, a shift in perspective, and a shift maybe in consciousness and awareness. And that shift is a big inflection point and, you know, kind of a point of no return. The nice thing about this process is I think for different people, that shift happens in different spots along the process. So, you know, for the process to succeed, it's got to happen. I strongly believe no one has ever accomplished their goals in a meaningful way and reached a state where they feel like they live a meaningful life without going through that qualitative transformation. But it does happen, and it's supposed to happen during the process. And when it's not software and you work with your clients, you observe it and you see when it does. So that's it about meaningful goal pursuit, kind of from a more informational point of view. The course is a little different. In the course, those of you who choose to register, we're going to go through the process together, but also learn the theory behind it in each part of the sequence. And then also, even before diving in, it's really important to understand better the structure of motivation. Motivation is a very, very complicated thing, and there's great research that shows how motivation works in different situations, how it can be cultivated, also how motivation is sometimes undermined, often undermined where actually where external rewards are introduced. So it's a little counterintuitive thing about how motivation works that's important to understand. One of the questions that one of you asked is what meaning is. So what does meaning mean? And that it is subjective, and I think that is key to understand. Meaning in life is indeed very subjective. So we're going to go with start with Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning and kind of the more philosophical view of that, and then look at different aspects of meaning that are a little more contemporary. One of them is Tal Ben-Shahar's approach, who is a positive psychologist, and how does meaning kind of disperse itself between present and future. So it's really interesting stuff. Then understand the models that tie the positive emotions in the present and with the meaning that comes from imagining a meaningful future. In a way, motivation is all about those positive emotions. It's that sense of lighting up, that sense of fuel, that sense of being on fire, right? And the objective in the course is both to learn and experience the entire thing yourself, so you can get a subjective sense of what it feels like and what it takes like to go through it. So that's it about that. Thank you for listening so far, and I'm glad to take any questions that you may have. And just remember to press star 6 if you're muted. No questions.
I have a question.
Please.
Okay. My background, so you should know, and I think it influences me. My background is law, practicing law and teaching as a law professor. Also, psychoanalysis. I'm still in my analysis, going to the fifth year. What I have as a problem here is, and you please educate me because I don't think I know what I'm saying, but what bothers me, and give me a few minutes, so I'll go down some things. What bothers me about the whole plan is it's factually based. It is based on content, I think, that is outside and out in the environment. I think that your goals get to be very meaningful, but that meaningfulness and whether or not it is, can be obtained is also based on outside facts. And my concern is twofold. What if the person using your program either makes a mistake on the facts, misinterprets the facts, and what does that do to your conclusions based on your software? Two examples. Baseball. Different baseball players can see a ball or not. There are people, like Ted Williams, there are people who can read the ball, see the curvature on it, and know that it's going to be a curveball, and they're going to be able to hit it because they're going to be positioned. There are other baseball players, and this actually happened, that didn't have the visual acuity of Ted Williams at all, and they can't hit the way he did because they are mistaking the factual content, if you will, of the baseball. Now, let me get to law, which I know something about. For me, law is all dependent upon, again, outside facts. A litigation, I think, and that's what I did for quite a while, is going to be based on the interpretations that each side in the litigation has for respecting the law. So I have argued 100 times in trials that the same facts, that these facts in this principle, in this context, produce why. And that these facts that my opposing counsel has and will argue, no, you're interpreting the facts consistent with your, quote, vision.
Mm-hmm.
But that's wrong. How do you handle what I just said?
Well, let me try to address that. I'm not sure I completely understand what you mean by facts, but...
outside stuff. Outside stuff beyond you. That's in the environment.
So keep in mind, I mean, all of this content, everything that's being fed into a program like this comes from the person herself or himself, right? And the challenge is, in a way, how to... I agree, and I think that it maybe is what you're saying. It's always a challenge to kind of milk that out. I think a lot of people spend a lot of time wondering what is meaningful for them, and they don't know.
Yeah.
But I think That's on one hand. On the other hand, when something is meaningful to you, you do know. And there's a very, very strong, very powerful subjective feeling where something is meaningful to you. The way to address that, in my view, is just to try to do that milking from different perspectives, to try to do it from different angles, to do it in that multidimensional way where maybe you do one exercise and you think that's your vision, then another one, you get a slightly different thing, especially in the early stages where you kind of start with a clean slate, and then it converges. So I think that's why it's really important to start to linger there in the beginning, and not to just kind of charge on the road and go like, hey, let's do it. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's...
No.
Those are my thoughts.
Well, I respect your thoughts, and you know more about this than I do. You're probably on the way. I don't. But a reason why I differ with your thoughts is you said the client personally is the source of the facts. That and what's meaningful to you has to be based on the facts, and I suggest to you that two things: the facts could be wrong on the outside world, or the person's, the coach's or the coachee's perception, interpretation of those facts could be very, very different. You argue, if you will, that true meaningfulness, mistake will be derived from a multitude of and a perspective of many different angles, and you hold the view that as a result of that wide perspective, many different angles, you're going to get, in a sense, an untainted meaningfulness.
Oh, okay. I mean, I think this could be a longer discussion.
Oh yeah.
So, but thank you for that insight. I think that is important. And by the way, definitely, I don't think this or any process is perfect, right? It's something to think about always. Maintain some level of flexibility. This is, I think, this problem is not just a difficult problem to solve. It hasn't been solved yet. So it's possible that all of these solutions are suboptimal, but they still, you know, they work to a greater degree than others.
So and if those are the only ones that exist,
I just wanted to jump in with a question at some point.
Please.
Yeah, I would too. So
okay, thanks. I had trouble getting in before. I don't know if other people had trouble. The line wouldn't unmute on my other phone. I had to call in again. But thank you so much for this presentation, and I'm very interested and engaged in what you're talking about and impressed. And I didn't hear you mention, unless I missed it, emotions and as well as people's resistance to pursuing, you know, sort of internal conflicts about what goals they want to pursue. So I wonder if you could address both those things.
Yes. So, and they're, both of them are tied, right? Because the resistance is emotional as well. So I think that's what's kind of hard to it's a little difficult to explain. It's kind of a little easier to experience. But very loosely speaking, I will say the following. The fact that it's a very structured process, and it seems like it's a little mechanical, maybe initially, and so on, is not a way to avoid these emotions. In fact, it's the other way around. It's a way to surface these emotions, but surface them in context. What happens is I think for a lot of people, when they just kind of think about the problem they're trying to solve, they know for a fact that they're not satisfied with the way they live right now. They know that they don't feel a good sense of meaning, not enough, and they want to solve this problem. The emotions are not harnessed to solve the problem because they're not put in the right context. If the problem you're trying to solve at any given day is the context is narrower and you just have to deal with this one thing, then you can actually harness these emotions to help you. So I know that's a little abstract, but generally that's my thought. It is actually a very emotional process to go through, and I think it has to. And I think that that fuel, that motivation, you know, that word that I keep using, motivation in social sciences is considered to be something cognitive by a lot of people. In my view, it's completely emotional. So I don't know if that answers your question. That's a little partial, but the emotions are there.
I wonder if you're able to give an example.
I have a question. Can I just ask a question quickly? Just
then I'll go after you then. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do you have like an actual software program that you use to enter this information in? I mean, you said you were developing software at some point, and do you have a website or resource where we can find out more?
So there's nothing that does this whole thing beginning to end, and I think actually it's hard to do that. There are two applications. There's an iPhone application called Live Happy that we developed back in 2009, and that has a goal section that has some of this content, and it also has some other more emotional-related interventions like gratitude and so on. So it's a little broader. That's one. And there's an iPad application called Be Life, the letter B, Life, just that. That we did together with Heidi Grant Halvorsen, which a lot of this content is actually in her book called Succeed. And that's a little more aligned with what I described here today. Ironically, this started with the software. So one of the things that we actually realized over the years is that it's extremely difficult to do this in a completely self-directed way, I think for obvious reasons, right? So we were starting a trial. We actually started a trial last year and continuing it now, where we let people use the software or the mobile application every day, but we also give their permission visibility of the data they put in to a coach. So the coach works with the software.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably going to be, you know, ideal. Because there's a lot of stuff. The software is very good at being in your pocket and reminding you and you know, all of the structured, simple things that software does well. But I'm not aware of any digital tool that was able to form an alliance.
Well, this is where my question comes in then. About alliances and software. I'm Dr. Hope Kelman, and thank you very much for your presentation. I've been a PhD psychologist for 25 years and just did the healthcare bill on the mental health side, telecommunications. And I'm very interested in the applications on the web-based soft, the new possibilities of doing this in-home with people in offices, doing coaching only over the phone. And we have this program in Kauai in February that works with the emotions and coaching. But I'm really grateful that I'm talking to Israel right now. And I wanted to ask you if there's anything on the horizon in any new programs that you're planning to create.
Well, thank you. I mean, I there is. There's a lot of stuff coming. I think that for us, what we're trying to do in the past few years with incremental success, I think possibly with much greater success very soon, is to create at least a level of engagement with the software without any human in the loop, so that the software keeps you at least engaged at a pedestrian level, and then a coach or a practitioner can be a part of it as well. So if you actually go to mybelife.com, there's a subscription service we launched a few months ago. It's still in progress, and I'm not sure that it's perfect yet, but that's kind of the latest and greatest and a good indication to what's coming.
Dialogue with you. I've got a number of people that I've collaborated with here. I visit in Los Angeles, and Gary Young, who's the creator of Emotional Freedom Technique, who actually has done a very good job on doing all of this through web presentations of the possibility of developing some new programs. So I'll email you. I'm from Kauai, Hawaii, and it's Dr. Kelman, and I look forward to talking with you again.
Great. That'll be great. Thank you.
So do you, back to my question, do you have a website yourself?
Oh, it's, so my personal website is rideofyourlife.com. And that's focused on the motorcycle project and the interviews, but it's also my blog. And in fact, if you go, there's this very interesting timing. If you go to greatest.com, that's great, and then ist.com, on their home page, just a few hours ago, I posted a pretty long blog post exactly about this content, kind of 10 steps to a meaningful life, which, by the way, originally this talk had a question mark at the end. So that's one great asset. You can look. There's a lot of references there, and you know, some scientific references and some other references. So it's a great article to go through. And my personal website is rideofyourlife.com. My email is ran@rideofyourlife.com, and everyone feel free to email me. I'm always glad to engage in conversation.
Can you repeat your email again, please?
It's Ran, R-A-N, like Nancy, at rideofyourlife, in one word, .com.
Is your
spelled
out? Is your spelled out, Y-O-U-R?
Yes. So rideofyourlife.com.
Thank you.
Any other questions, anyone? Okay. So thank you again for showing up and for listening, and I hope engage in... Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. It's hard to get unmuted. It takes a minute. So I'm just wondering how one would experience this process. Like, are there ways to connect with someone who's already practicing? Or are you just training people now?
Well, I mean, at the moment, I'm just, the course is a way to get trained. There's a little, worksheet that I put together. I haven't yet formalized it into anything. There's nothing right now that you can just like download or, and the ILCT course is basically the training on the method.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Rand.
All right. Thank you, everyone. And I hope to hear and meet some of you soon in the course in a few weeks. So thanks. Bye-bye.